paper 16, section 7, which is at the bottom of old single column, page 192. Okay, another very solid section for the first of these three sections that follow the foundational section of paper 16, section 6. Like I said last time, think of these three sections as an essay on the three cosmic intuitions. And we'll start with this first one, and I most likely spend the evening on it. Maybe just one thing to point out up front. Remember we had three cosmic intuitions: first being the logical acumen, second the moral discrimination, third the spiritual insight. And we'll see as we go through these next two sections how I decided upon using those three labels to give the three intuitions a nice little direct label.
Could you say those three labels again?
The logical acumen, moral discrimination, and the spiritual insight. And so, they gave them to you in that order, 1, 2, 3. And so the first thing that you notice is they're starting with 2. Okay. Basically, they're starting with the moral discrimination, second cosmic intuition. We've seen this pattern a number of times. It's the same reason that you, instead of saying beauty, truth, goodness, you say truth, beauty, goodness. Now you do it 2, 1, 3 instead of 1, 2, 3. Okay. Because they're wanting to stress just in the title, or what they've chosen to put first is telling you, all right, they really want me now to take these three and see them in a fundamentally top-down point of view. Where that second one, the one that we numbered 2, is the super additive consequence of the relationship between the endpoints. So it's above, actually. Okay? So when you look at things from the top down, that's what you see first. That's going to be the point of your triunity nature, which is most intimate with the cosmos, as it were. The top point of view, reaching up to whatever the bottom point of the cosmos is that you can make contact with. And so that's your engagement point. And the fact that they start out with morals, virtue, and personality, the foundation of any sort of a cosmic character is that recognition that you have a duty to the cosmos. That moral recognition. That's where it all begins. And then you take it down to a duty to others and up to a duty to the other, to God. And so, so you can see it's just, it's a point that they really want you to get by putting, of all things that they could put first, putting morality first. All right, let's read a little bit here.
Oh, here we go.
7, morale, virtue, and personality. Intelligence alone cannot explain the moral nature. Morality, virtue is indigenous to human personality. Moral intuition, the realization of duty, is a component of human mind endowment and is associated with other inalienables of human nature. Scientific curiosity and spiritual insight. Man's mentality far, far descends that of animal cousins.
Transcends.
But his...
Transcends.
But his moral and religious natures that especially distinguish him from the animal world.
Okay, so let's just start. You can see how many paragraphs they've broken this into. You know, notice that right up front? Whole bunch of little paragraphs. So we'll just take them, you know, very methodically, one at a time. Okay, intelligence alone cannot explain the moral nature. Okay, remember, we have these words, intellectual, mental, mindal, all dealing with, you know, similar things, that associative block. Intellectual, in distinction from mental, is indicating the highest domains of mentality. So when they say intelligence alone, so in other words, even up to the seventh adjutant, or in terms of the levels of meaning, you know, even all the way up to the third level of meaning, just in and of itself, you know, as if there isn't levels above it, intelligence alone cannot explain the moral nature. Because the second cosmic intuition, the moral discrimination, is why there's which level of meaning?
Level of mind.
Five, the moral level. Right. The third is the level of mind. Okay, you know, when you have all seven adjutants, you're considered to be minded in the eyes of the universe. Okay, so that first statement, you know, is just very obvious in the levels of meaning. Three is less than five. You know, to have a moral nature, you need the fifth level of meaning. Okay, now morality, and then they say, or alternatively, we could use the word virtue. Is indigenous to human personality. Okay, so it's born into, indigenous. We are encircled in the Holy Spirit by grace. You know, she births that into us. Okay, it's indigenous. Now, why... virtue. You know, see, they're going to really stress the word virtue a little bit more than morality. Well, what does the word virtue mean? Okay, that V-I-R root there, okay, is Latin. It's the same as the W-E-R in Old English, you know, both stemming off of the Indo-European root, you know, W-E-R-E, wolf, werewolf, man-wolf. Okay, that V-I-R or W-E-R in Old English, that's man. Okay, so what the word virtue truly means is human quality, human quality. Okay, so, that's, you know, is indigenous to human personality? Human quality is indigenous to human personality? Yeah. See, using the word virtue, it's very direct, just by definition. Okay. Yep.
Gaelic F-I-R.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so they're all stemming off the same, you know, Indo-European root. So. All right, so virtue. Human quality. So moral intuition, again, so you know, just keep repeating here, so our second cosmic intuition. And then they say the realization of duty. Okay, now wait a minute. I mean, when we first talked about this second cosmic intuition, we were just focusing on the recognition of duty. They've taken it up a notch, the realization of duty. Yes, by grace, like I just said, we are given an initial measure of realization of those three, of relationship to those three cosmic intuitions. That's the gift of encirclement in the Holy Spirit, the Creative Mother Spirit gave you. An initial measure of realization of duty just by grace. It's there. You're going to have to ignore it, that initial measure. You don't have to choose it into existence. It's there by grace. Okay? So that initial realization of duty is there to be in play. See, and it's a component of human mind endowment and is associated with the other inalienables of human nature, scientific curiosity, and spiritual insight. Okay. So now just stop again and recognize that you want this sentence to be about you. Okay? If you don't have moral intuition, scientific curiosity, and spiritual insight, then you're not functioning as a human. You don't have human quality. You can't just have moral intuition or you can't just have spiritual insight. You have to have all three or you're not of human quality. Okay? Especially, you know, again, you know, we have this order like truth, beauty, goodness. Like the beauty one, we have scientific curiosity. You don't have to be some intense analytic, you know, person or something. But if you don't have any scientific curiosity, if you aren't curious about the facts, if you say, oh, you don't need facts to get through life, recognize what you're actually choosing. You're saying, I don't have to function as a human. I can get by as an animal. Do you really want to say that about yourself? As I said, they're throwing down the gauntlet again. They did it several times, and I tried to point that out in the previous section. It's just right there. Choose. You want to be human or not? Do you want the word virtue to apply to you? You want to be man, you know, human or animal? Yeah, Jason.
Would it be less discriminating or more in sync modern thought to think of it as full human potential, or the full fullness of potential to actualize? I mean, not the fullness of actualization, but the fullness of potentialization.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but don't give yourself even that measure of wiggle room. Have the courage to take it on directly. Call a spade a spade. Yes, there's infinite grace. But we're trying to challenge ourselves to not be a child forever. We want to grow up. We want to start trying to be an adult of God.
Well, can I say acting as a fully potentializing?
No. I mean, you can't do that. That's going too far. I mean,
That's in a verb instead of trying to make it a noun.
All we're trying to get at is don't be afraid to recognize that there's a reason why they said it's sad to record. Okay, the angels don't have tears for no reason. It's very sad for them. That by and large, these objects that are shaped in this human shape are not choosing to function as a human. They're getting by with their animal nature. Now, it's a very fancy animal. It can do lots of really cool things. Okay, but you need to draw a bright line. You're not going to be called a human in the eyes of the universe if you're, you know, just rejecting the notion of scientific curiosity.
Okay. We're talking about the definition that the revelators are giving us, not what we want to conceive as a norm.
Do you want to be a student of the revelation?
Yes.
Right. Then you want to think exactly the way the revelators do. What did Jesus say about love? Did he say, you don't have to love like God does. You don't have to love like the celestials are attempting to love, those above you are attempting to love. You can just do the easier thing, the animal feeling thing. No, he said, I challenge you to take it up a notch. Go beyond brotherly love, okay? That's the whole point of the fifth epical revelation. Go beyond the current state of things. All right, man's mentality far transcends that of his animal cousins. but it is his moral and religious natures that especially distinguish him from the animal world. To put a whole level, the fourth level of meaning, between you and the animals, as they pointed out, you know, when you're really up there in five and six, okay, now you are really distinct from even super fancy animal, you know, that you could imagine just the subjective aspect of the seventh adjutant. But, like I said, I mean, remember that there's a reason why Jesus called the third level of meaning the level of mind. Okay? He's reminding you that when he says, you know, in the fear of the Lord section, I find you on the first and second levels of meaning, you know, that anguish, dread, awe, reverence, first and second levels of meaning, so I find you there. Another way of saying that is, I find you submindal, and I would lead you up. You know, it's that stark in the idea. When you're just feeling, that, if that's the best you can come up with, is intense feelings, you're submindal in the eyes of the universe. Those are the words that Jesus chose. So again, see, throwing down the gauntlet like this, you know, and having the courage to take on that challenge. All right, let's read another paragraph.
Okay, the selective response of an animal is limited to the motor level of behavior. The supposed insight of the higher animals is a motor level and usually appears only after the experience of motor trial and error. Man is able to exercise scientific, moral, and spiritual insight prior to all exploration of or experimentation.
Okay. I see. So you see that I wasn't out of order in bringing up animal. They're bringing it right on. Okay. They're trying to get you to recognize what's considered to be an animal in the eyes of the universe. You know, and even when you talk about a higher animal, where you've got things that, you know, you have a strong inclination to anthropomorphize and, you know, think of, that's an instinct just like I have. You see the supposed instinct line there. Okay. And it's definitely some of those higher adjutant aspects of a higher animal can be quite compelling to interpret as being human-like behavior. See, it's on a motor level. You know, it's just a really fancy machine. Okay. By and large, which is because an animal pretty much just exists in the moment. I mean, you have a little bit of qualification when you get up to the higher animals, you know, because after all, when you're watching animals, you're really sort of watching the creative Mother Spirit's mind. Okay, so obviously, you know, there can be some shades of greater nature just because it's her mind. But by and large, you have something that's just, as an individual, is in the moment, you know, and it's just chugging along in the moment through trial and error.
First three adjutants.
Well, I mean, if it's a, you know, higher animal, you have all five, you know, but, yeah.
Is it just through that influence of the creative mother's mind that animals can be observed caring for one another? Or, like I recently saw a video, you know, of elephants mourning the death of one. And
right.
There are times when they appear to show real concern.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, remember with, yeah, I mean, any animal that has more than the first three adjutants is going to have some functioning on the level of the feelings, on the second level of meaning. If they not only have the fourth, but they also have the fifth adjutant, like an elephant does, you know, the most of any creature, you can have very, you know, profound feelings starting to be expressed. Remember, that's the social adjutant. You know, you have this very definitive, profound social consciousness that that elephant has, with lots of feelings associated with it, right up to the boundary of the sixth adjutant. You know, they take it right to the point where they practically, you know, have the notion of an afterlife and mourning the dead. You know, anyone who studied elephants, no, you know, they take that fifth adjutant right up to, you know, the boundary, which for us, you know, transitions over into the sixth adjutant. But for them, it's just a barrier. But yeah, so very profound feelings. But it's still, no matter how profound the feeling, it's just the second level of meaning. Okay? And that's a far cry from the moral level.
They did an experiment on Scientific American a decade or two ago, and where this individual had both hemispheres of his brain, one was destroyed to a certain extent, and the other hemisphere was operating normally. Mm-hmm. And they had him do, you know, left and right hand according to the hemispheres of the brain. And when he, they asked him to press a button, and he would press the button, and then right after that, they would ask him, did you press the button? Mm-hmm. And he would answer. With the good hemisphere of the brain, he would press the button when they told him to. He responded like an animal. But then when they asked him, did you press the button? He said, yes, I did. With the damaged hemisphere, he responded like an animal when they gave him the command, press the button. Then they asked him, did you press the button? Mm-hmm. And he couldn't answer them.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, again, just... Right, the more you're just kind of limited to the moment, see, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, like I've tried to point out on the chart, you have the first three are in the moment adjutants very definitively. But you start to have a little bit, you know, of a long-term consciousness with the next three. But you don't have anything like what they're beginning to allude to at the end of that paragraph. Man is able to exercise scientific, moral, and spiritual insight prior to all exploration or experimentation, okay? Prior to all, okay? So if you have the notion that the only way you can understand something is to walk a mile in its moccasins, okay, an adage that humans love to repeat, okay, you know, and especially if you take it almost to a quasi-religious sort of a belief that, you know, where you say there's absolutely no way to have any understanding of something unless you walk a mile in its moccasins. What are you actually saying there? You're saying that you have no experience with human consciousness. You've never experienced human consciousness before if you absolutely believe that. That the only way that you can understand something is to walk a mile in its moccasins. A human knows otherwise. See, so just see how they're throwing down the gauntlet. They're trying to challenge us with all of these things that we love to just, it's like, oh, we all know. It's common knowledge, that moccasin thing. Like, no, okay, that's not, it's sad to record that there's so many people that are so devoid of any use of that initial encirclement of grace, even of your human nature, that they don't even know that about this word prior, okay, to all exploration or experimentation. Okay, and when you talk about insight prior, you know, rather than just saying insight, we're kind of getting to that other word that has sight as the root, foresight. Remember how we've stressed that you want to move up from legacy, tradition, convention to wisdom, insight, foresight. Okay, where you're really starting to function at a human level, wisdom, insight, foresight. If you have something in front of you, and you want to distinguish between two aspects of it. you have that basic word distinguish. Distinguish A from B. Okay. If you bring in these subtle, in terms of human history, has been a very subtle additional influence into that comparison. If you bring wisdom, insight, or foresight into that distinguishing, there's another word that describes it. There's this subtle addition in play. Discrimination. The word discrimination implies that you've gone beyond just an animal comparison. To be discriminating is to be human. To merely distinguish is just what you can do as an animal. Okay. So again, think about the challenges there. We get a little bit of spiritual consciousness, and just like Jason was kind of pointing out, sort of common wisdom, that's afoot. It's like that word discriminate. Ooh, we don't really want to ever go near that. Okay? If you're actively trying to never do anything that you think would probably be described by the word discrimination, you're actively trying to not be human. That which doesn't discriminate is that which isn't human in its manifestation. It's a subhuman consciousness trying to rationalize life, trying to get through life. You must discriminate. The three cosmic intuitions are the three discriminations. Okay? Because wisdom, insight, foresight. You're bringing in insight. You're bringing in that's a subtler influence into that distinguishing. Okay, just 1 second. And and it doesn't matter if it's exploration or experimentation, like they're saying. Just because you get fancy and pretend that you're a scientist because you use the word experiment or something. Okay, I mean it doesn't change it. Okay, either way, very much you have the three cosmic intuitions, which just directly you'd say are insight. You have the seventh adjutant. It gives you wisdom in the full sense, the spirit of wisdom. And personality, just in and of itself, is what gives you that future consciousness. To really bring in foresight. Okay, yeah, you had something?
There was something that came up in my mind in the Arranged book. And it talked, I think it goes beyond the kindness level of... Don't just be willing or meagerly to want to have pity on your fellow. I'm not saying exactly word for word.
Right, right.
Pity on your fellow brothers and sisters. But another word that came up in my mind was being empathetic. Instead of just being, finding pity on everyone, find a little unselfishness to that, right?
Yeah, but they're just, all those words are really problematic. I mean, to be just purely empathetic is to be just a totally subjective. You just are totally turned around and are just glued onto something, as an empath. And if it says jump, you jump.
Instead of just saying, I don't know you. The only person I know is God and myself. So how can I, I can just disconnect and say, how can I really understand you? Or
What's the word that Jesus taught us to do there? Compassionate. With the suffering. Don't become the suffering. That's empathic. That's empathy. You are with it, not of it. Compassion. See, again, that's only an objective consciousness can be compassionate. A subjective consciousness, your animal, your adjutant consciousness, your fancy animal, can't do that. It can't be that close to it without being of it. It'll just get sucked right into it like a drop of water in the ocean. To be able to stand separate and be able to actually bring help, not just be more of the same, more of the problem, more of that which needs help, more courageous and independent cosmic thinking, standing apart and solid. Okay. All right, and then oh, we got one.
Does compassion have wisdom in it?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, again, when we're going to try to build up the facets of cosmic character. Coincidentally, I just happen to have that sitting next to me. You know, remember the little thing I did, you know, about the facets of cosmic character. Fortitude, tolerance, patience, forbearance, altruism, forgiveness. How those are constructed by taking the levels of meaning, bringing them up and creating those facets out of the rungs of the ladder. You want this full-rounded character. If it isn't all of those cosmic characteristics together as one, none of them are true. It's not true.
It's not real compassion.
Right. It's not true compassion. Yeah.
So would that apply with being discriminating too? Because it would, if you're unbalanced and you're not bringing in the whole big picture, mm-hmm. that's when you have the issue.
That's why the word has all these negative connotations. Because it's sad to record that most people just have a little vague notion of the higher nature and they drag it down into the muck and turn it into a negative thing. All these things that are meant to be high, positive values get turned totally 180 degrees around, perverted. Right?
Only a personality can know what it is doing before it does it. Only personalities possess insight in advance of experience. A personality can look before it leaps and can therefore learn from looking as well as from leaping. A non-personal animal ordinarily learns only by leaping.
Again, that famous old passage about that, about the looking and the leaping. And again, you know, just notice how they're... You don't have to infer... If it's not human, it's animal. They're putting it down very definitively. They're throwing down the gun. A non-personal animal ordinarily learns only by leaping. So if you go, well, I think that's the only way I've ever learned anything is by leaping. Oh, dear.
I did have that thought.
It's sad to record that... I'm not recorded as a person very much yet in the records of the angels.
It's working so well for me.
Right.
No, I didn't have that thought.
See?
Yeah, but it's beating my body up.
Yeah. In other words, look before you leap.
Right. I mean, you know, like I said, I mean, just one of the most basic things of using the personality in and of itself is to have a consciousness of the future. To be able to, to step out of the moment in your mind, see the big picture, see the connectivity and the causality, the logical structure of things, and know what's up ahead there, without having to actually trip over it. Okay, that you know. What's that one thing that they say that will help develop your three cosmic intuitions and make you more human, more really living? Reflection. That state of stepping up, seeing the big picture, objective consciousness. I think you get the point there. They're really driving that home. You don't want to be called an animal in the eyes of the universe. It's not, if you don't take delight in cultivating, material gravity will make sure that that's all you are. Material gravity acts downward, not upward, and your material mind, your agitant mind, is pulled downward. It will just lay at the bottom of the bowl unless you choose, you know, to encircuit yourself more in the Holy Spirit, so that there's spiritual gravity that lifts you up. Yeah. It's just the laws of mind energy. They're trying to just make it very clear. Now, you want to be above that dividing line that Jesus called the level of mind. All right.
As a result of experience, an animal becomes able to examine the different ways of attaining a goal and to select an approach based on accumulated experience. But a personality who can also examine the goal itself and pass judgment on in worthwhileness, its value. Intelligence alone can discriminate as to who best means of attaining indiscriminate ends. But a moral being possesses an insight which enables him to discriminate between ends as well as means. And a moral being, in choosing virtue, is nonetheless intelligent. He knows what he is doing and why he is doing it, where he is going, and how he will get there.
Yeah, let's just touch on that last part first, because it ties into what you were bringing up there, Terry. That whole bit about, and a moral being in choosing virtue is nonetheless intelligent, you know, wise or any other thing. I mean, you're going to be all these things. You're not going to be in some sort of dichotomy mode where in order to be this, I have to cease to be that other positive thing. So when you look at that list, okay, you have all those basic questions. Who, what, where, when, which, why, how. And, of course, you know, we're really bringing in human consciousness when we ask why. Yeah, and see, and it's there, why he is doing it. But that doesn't mean that you're off in some abstract space. You're still connected to things. You have the what and the where, you know, of course, the when and, yeah, et cetera. The who, you probably, yeah. And you've got your second adjutant, your analytic thing going. You have the how. You have it all in play. You've got the full picture happening. Now back up to the beginning there. So you have this basic in-the-moment fact of an animal, you know, having a sequence of experiences. It has memory. The animal has memory, so a memory builds up, and as they're pointing out, you know, I know that if I do that, my paws hurt, so I'm not going to do that, you know, and it remembers that, and it takes the other path. But a personality can also examine the goal itself and pass judgment on its worthwhileness, its value. Now, here's another really important literal meaning of the words point. Just like virtue, okay, to recognize exactly what that means. Worthwhileness, okay? Worth. We know the word worth and the word value are often played together, being practically like synonyms. What's the difference? Why do we have these two different words in the language? Okay. The word, the root of worth there, and you might suspect it's starting with a W, that's the old English branch off of the Indo-European root. In Latin, it's V-E-R, like verse, like universe, one turning. It's the turning word, worth. Huh. So what's the difference then between worth and value? Okay, value, you know, is the spirit word. Okay, value is the word that if you're using it correctly, recognizing it correctly, that's about the unity aspect. The word value is speaking to the unity aspect. If you turn it around, turning, to the individuality aspect, that's the worth. So a value turned around, you know, in its engagement of the individuality, that's worth. See, that's literally what the word means, turned around, worth. Value turned around into individuality as opposed to unity. And while, time, okay? See, so it's it's the individuality in time aspect, or from a from the unity of spirit perspective, the value. But you can't directly apply the value. You have to turn it around. You have to take the ideal into an idea. You have to take that value, bring it into relationship with individuality, so it's a worth, and get it to engage time, the whileness, so that it has worthwhileness, individuality in time. Your spirit consciousness doesn't know about time. The thing that sees the value directly, that third cosmic intuition, remember, is the ability to recognize spirit values. Okay, that third cosmic intuition sees the value directly. Yeah, but then you've got to bring it down into worthwhileness.
Into time.
Into time and individuality.
Just thinking about value and worth, value sort of connotes what is its function, what can it do, and worth means what are you willing to sacrifice for it.
Yeah, and see, this is the thing, you know, if you start looking at how we use the words, you can see shades of this proper differential. All you have to do is reconsecrate yourself to see, you know, recognizing clearly why we have two words. They're not to be used as synonyms. Yes, they're very related. They're the same thing looked at from the two different directions. Yes, but you must distinguish unity from individuality. Value is one thing, worth is another. And when you evaluate the circumstances of individuality, you know, you're taking value, you're drawing what is directly value, and you're pulling something out of that E value. You know, the E is EX. You've dropped the X, and you know, it means out. You pull value out and bring it into direct contact with individuality. You bring something down from unity, a quality down from unity. Put it into a relationship with individuality. Give it worth and wildness. You know, you got to give it, make sure that it has an ongoingness, this translation of value into worth. You can't just focus on a point. You can't just do the animal thing and look in the moment. You're going to have to take a bigger perspective in order to make it worthwhile.
You're going to have to reflect into that moment.
Yes.
To reflect into the individuality.
Yes, you are. Right?
It may take a while.
And it may take a while. Yeah. And
you know, one thing, of course, is to go beyond kindness and to go into compassion, which is to allow suffering to evolve.
To be compassionate is to be a parent to a child in need. Obviously, if you're still a child, you can't do that. You can only suffer as well. Again, I mean, a mere child of God can't do those things that Jesus asked us to do. There needs to be an adult in the room. There needs to be an adult of God. That's why he said, I would lead you up. One of the things that you're thinking about is, how do I start applying this? You're getting ahead of yourself. The duties... And that set, you know, up there at the end of the book that you can read about in there, they're given in a certain order. Moral duty, then ethical duty. You need to first worry about yourself. Forget about the others first. You need to first consecrate yourself to the universal harmony. You have to first make yourself an adult of God to some degree. Consecrate your mind to the cosmos. You have a duty to the cosmos. It's just you and the cosmos. There's not another individual anywhere. So if you need to bring into an individual to figure this out, then you're not thinking about the right thing. It's just you and the cosmos to start with. You're going to bring yourself into conformity with the cosmos. And then, having done that, you have some measure of parental status as a cosmic citizen. You might be able to help someone else. Okay? But if you're still grasping like they are, Now, if Jesus was just as grasping as all the people that he met, could he have helped them like he did?
When a man fails to discriminate the ends of his mortal striving, he finds himself functioning on the animal level of his existence. He has failed to avail himself of the superior advantages of that material acumen. Moral discrimination and spiritual insight, which are an integral part of his cosmic mind, endowment as a personal being.
Okay, see, so there you can see, it's almost right there. I mean, I used the moral discrimination and the spiritual insight. I didn't use material acumen. I combined with that with what's in the next section to make it logical acumen. Because I wanted to, I didn't want you to immediately misinterpret that it's just about matter. Now, the way we could do that right here is, instead of saying material acumen, I could say individuality acumen. Okay, and that would avoid thinking, well, it's just about dirt clods. Okay, you know, and clever ways of arranging them. Okay, okay, so that's, you know, so there's the three cosmic intuitions basically. And again, you know, they're stressing he has failed to avail himself, see, of that, even that initial gift of grace, that initial encirclement, makes you personal, human. Okay, now that first part, see, again, when man fails to discriminate the ends, again, like we're saying, I mean, discrimination is fundamentally a human characteristic. You must be discriminating. Or you've failed to avail yourself of your human nature. You're just trying to live as an animal if you don't discriminate. Critical thinking is you know, the earmark of human nature, you know, in contrast to animal nature. And you can see how this sentence is building off that last half of the previous paragraph that I hadn't you know, fleshed out yet. Let's go back and look at that. So after the worthwhileness, see, intelligence alone can discriminate as to the best means. Okay, so there it's using discriminate, but it's intelligence alone. It's like, okay, well, wisdom. I could bring in that subtlety of wisdom, and I could validly call the distinguishing discrimination. All right. Yeah, so that can discriminate as to the best means, but only of attaining indiscriminate ends. Let's stop and think about that one a second again. Indiscriminate ends, like random acts of kindness. That's a classic bumper sticker example of what they're talking about here. If you believe in random acts of kindness, what have you availed yourself of your... No, see, that's an animal thought. An animal thinks random acts of kindness. It's like, well, yeah, but it's kindness. That's the fourth level of meaning. Remember what they said? But it is his moral and religious natures that especially distinguish him from the animal world. Okay? Yeah, you're bringing in a little bit of, I mean, you have the notion of kindness, kin-likeness, because of that encirclement by grace, but you're not really, it's just there by that default mode, okay? The real problem is that you would stick the word random in front of it and thinking that you're doing something valuable, that you're doing something worthwhile. No, you're not. Animals can't do things that are worthwhile. Random acts of kindness are not worthwhile. They're valueless, as you haven't done the human thing. That's not a human thought. It's an animal, a fancy animal thought. Okay? Again, see, they're throwing down the gauntlet. They're trying to get us to stop just getting sucked into this common wisdom that's just we're a wash in. Like random acts of kindness and, you know, all these other things that that are on bumper stickers. No, I see, but a moral being, you know, someone with human quality possesses an insight which enables him to discriminate between ends as well as between means. You're not just maybe using a little wisdom. You're bringing in definitively insight and foresight. Okay? You're functioning as a human.
You know, what's common, we feel human because our ability to exalt the our feelings.
Right.
How do we, well, I could come up with my own thoughts, but I'll ask you. How do we know if we're exalting our feelings and our animal passions, or rather than actually accessing spiritual values?
That's one of those fundamentally catch 22 sorts of questions. For a human, it's self-evident. For a fancy animal, no amount of explanation will ever. And I don't like, I mean, you know, I'm not copping out here, but, you know, but I want to put that right up front, because, you know, that's the thing. I mean, when you actually have objective consciousness, it's just self-evident. That's just all there is to it. There is no, well, which, you know, page of what book do I turn to, you know, that explain? Yeah, it's just there as a recognition. You know that what you're doing is not merely delusional. However, everyone who knows not human consciousness will know, quote unquote, that you're delusional. Because they know that the only person who could have certitude like that is a delusional person. All right, see, again, I mean, that's all they know is animal consciousness. So nothing I say can change that. I mean, the more I say, the more they know I'm delusional. The more I try to explain, no, it's, you just know. Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, so all absolutists say, you know. This is the response you'll get. It's the only response you can get, because it's sad to record. Yeah. So what you're looking for in terms of, you know, yourself is you want to take delight in cultivating what you'll initially stumble upon. You have this initial encirclement by grace. And one day you go, wait a minute. That was sort of just there. I didn't seem to have to get my second adjutant out and dissect anything to figure that out. I seem to just recognize it. It's just obvious. I think maybe that's that little gift of grace that I was given. I think I maybe just stumbled upon it. I used it without even trying to. Okay, I want to remember that, how the clarity that was there when I saw that like that. And until it feels like that, again, I'm probably delusional. See, it's very important that you have that initial encirclement by grace, so that you have the ability to initially experience a self-evident recognition of something, and you will just initially stumble upon it. But the reason you'll stumble upon it is if you're trying. You're trying to not just be satisfied with what will get you by. Your parents probably just drummed into you as a little kid that you can always do better than what you just did. You want to keep trying. You may have gotten an A on that test. Try to get an A plus the next time. Okay? You're not going to be looked down upon if you don't, but I want you to be trying. I don't want you to be perfect, but I want you to be trying to be perfecting. Okay? It's possible to get 100%. See if you can do it. I remember, kind of the turning point in my younger daughter's life. And she sort of just stumbled upon this, you know, one year in high school. She got 100 on the test. And then she recognized there was also extra credit that the teacher was constantly, putting forward to try to help all the people that, you know, were falling quite a bit short, so they weren't, you know, they could do a little extra credit and make up for it a little bit. She goes, ooh, if I got 100 and I did all extra credit, I could get like 115 on every test. And she wasn't satisfied until she was. You have to take delight. She was delighted the first time she got 115. I mean, that satisfaction of knowing that that you're not just doing animal stuff now. You've taken a hold of yourself. You're beginning to master the self. The self is doing what it ought to do, not what it wants to do. Okay? The self, the animal origin self, its wants are all craven. They're very basal. Very selfish, very short-sighted, et cetera.
And you're perfectly on what I was going to say. There is a checklist, Gene, and that is the opposite of the Lucifer Rebellion, to have an open mind, to willing to hear other people's views, and to have a purpose of view.
Okay.
Right? Does that make sense, Chris? Is that beautiful?
One of the key things in there was the word purpose, was it not? Yeah. I mean, because only a person can know the word purpose. All right, let's get a little bit more.
Virtue is righteousness, conformity with the cosmos. To name virtues is not to define them, but to have them is to know them. Virtue is not mere knowledge, nor yet wisdom, but rather the reality of progressive experience in the attainment of ascending levels of cosmic achievement. In the day-by-day of mortal man, virtue was realized by the consistent choosing of good rather than evil, and such choosing ability is evidence of the possession of a moral nature.
Okay, so look at that first one. So virtue, human quality, is righteousness. It's as simple as that. If you're really human, you're right with the cosmos. By definition, there's not some, minutia of code, religious code that you've checked off all the check boxes in or something. Okay? Remember about Moses? He chose to use his three cosmic intuitions, and that was considered unto him righteousness. Okay? He demonstrated that at the very least, he was using the initial encirclement in the cosmos that he was given by grace. It is right. I mean, if you do nothing but just use what you're initially given, it was made right by grace. Okay? It's more than, even than some sort of a basic, minimum encirclement. It's a threat of supremacy. It couldn't be any righter. Okay? It couldn't conform with the cosmos anymore. It conforms with the total finite. It's a threat of supremacy. Okay? It is indeed right. Okay? And just using that will take you head and shoulders above the animal and most of your brethren. And again, a conformity with the cosmos. Notice how you're striking step with it. You're an independent object who's consecrated its mind to be a harmony like the universal harmony. Now, to name virtues is not to define them, but to live them is to know them. Okay, well, the last part there, but to live them is to know them. Ah, they're bringing in that whole really living thing that we were stressing. Okay, yeah, like I was just kind of pointing out, if you're really living, okay, you're righteous. Otherwise, I wouldn't be properly using the word really. Okay, but that first part, what are they referring to there? Does anyone know when they say to name virtues is not to define them? Is that, what's the subtext there? Does anyone know? Is anyone enough of a student of history or philosophy to appreciate what they're alluding to there? You ever heard of like cardinal virtues or theological virtues? Okay, lists of words.
Codified virtues.
Yeah, okay. You know, where you name them. Okay, like the ancient Greeks and the cardinal virtues. You know that some of those ancient Greeks were really into that virtue thing. You remember, like, for instance, you know, those isms, what was one of those isms those ancient peoples had that they were really into virtue? Remember the list and up in the Jesus papers, and there's cynicism and there's
stoicism.
See? Yep. Okay, so those cardinal virtues, see if I can remember them off the top of my head. Justice, prudence, and then, remember these here? A couple of these lower ones, fortitude and temperance. Justice, prudence, fortitude, and temperance. Okay. Prudence, material pragmatism. Okay. In contrast to spiritual idealism. See, notice what those list of four virtues that they had tend to be focusing a little bit more on the lower levels, of the levels of meaning, the lower domains of the hourglass, a little bit more on kind of on the individuality side. Justice, prudence, okay, fortitude, you know, and temperance. And then there's the theological virtues, another list. This time it's three. Remember how 1 Corinthians 13 ends? That's where those three, you know, so the Greeks had those cardinal virtues, and the Christians have the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity. The older translations, you know, they put love in there and in the newer ones. But the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity. Oh, charity. See, now that's suggestive of altruism. You know, and kind of a little bit more that upper domain, but, you know, sort of just the spiritual, you know, pure unity part of it. Faith, hope, charity. So you can see they were both for kind of grasping at a little bit of the two different domains, okay. But they're pointing out, you know, it doesn't matter. Even if the faith, hope, charity is a little bit more of the upper levels of meaning, that's not the point. Okay, the point is to have all of those facets of cosmic character. Where you've transcended the levels of meaning, and you've brought it all up into a loop on a cosmic level. You know, the rungs have become facets of a holistic cosmic character. And notice what they did there. Virtue is not mere knowledge, nor yet wisdom. Okay, so kind of taking it up. But rather the reality of progressive experience in the attainment of ascending levels of cosmic achievement. What do we call ascending the ascending levels of cosmic achievement? The psychic circles, the cosmic levels. Okay. I'm saying, you know, get it on the first of the cosmic levels, you know, as a holistic structure, and then do like they're saying, progressively move it up the cosmic levels. All right, and And then that last part is where they're, you know, reminding you, you know, this whole bit about right and wrong and moral choices, you know, it's the associative intuition. You know, and you have the unity on the one side. I mean, you have goodness and ungoodness, or goodness and badness, good and bad. And, something is right or wrong depending on whether or not you've linked, let's assume you got a hold of fact. You know, have you linked the fact to goodness or not? Or did you link it to badness, which is a wrong choice? Yeah. And of course, you may have wanted to link it to goodness, but there were issues and you plugged it into badness instead. You had the best of intentions. It's still wrong, still a wrong choice, whether you knew it was wrong or not. It was a wrong choice. So they're bringing in that little bit of the details there of exactly what a right and wrong choice is, what moral choice is. All right. And such choosing ability is evidence of the possession of a moral nature. When a child makes its first moral choice, that's evidence that sometime prior to that, the seventh adjutant engaged that brain, and the creative mother spirit encircuited that fully adjutant mind into the Holy Spirit. So that there was the first, second, third cosmic intuitions, especially the second, moral discrimination. Yeah. Because you know that's evidence that there is encirclement in the Holy Spirit. The word moral wouldn't be in the dictionary if we weren't encircled. Yeah, hold on just a second here.
What if you should find yourself in a situation where there's an individual who's about to inflict great destruction on a number of individuals?
Mm-hmm.
And if you are in a position where you might be able to stop that person, but in order to do so, you have to inflict harm on that person.
Yeah, a great example of someone who's constantly in that state are the Virandadex, you know, like the Most High Observer. That's the only things he's called to decide upon. That's his job to make those decisions. right. All of his decisions are for, you know, what's for the greatest good, for the greatest number of people, the greatest length of time. Which means things are going to go quite poorly for some small number of people for some short period of time. You know, people are going to die most likely. He is going to make a decision that those people are going to die for the greater good.
So there's maybe a greater number can live.
Right. Or, and of course, he's not so much into whether or not you live or die. I mean, he's looking at the civilization. He's looking at the big picture. He's making sure that there is an immutable path to the age of light and life. For the civilization on this planet, the individuals come and go, in the blink of an eye.
Origin, history, and destiny.
Mm-hmm. Origin, history, destiny, again, in a way of thinking about the big picture like that. Yeah. Obviously, this is going to be difficult for any of us to have the objective perspective that a Virandadex observer has, for instance. You have to just take delight in cultivating when you can to have as much objective consciousness. So when one of those, crisis moments befalls you, you have some chance of doing what the right thing is. Remember those great words of comfort in this regard up in the Jesus Papers. If you do your best in the moment to assess it as well as you can, that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. even if you end up, plugging it into badness, plugging the facts into badness instead of goodness, in the whole origin, history, destiny, big picture, you tried the best that you could to do the right thing, and that's, you're judged on that. You have people like Veronetic Observers, just because someone needs to make sure that when humans try and fail, that nothing goes severely wrong. I mean, they're going to make sure that the big picture doesn't go fundamentally wrong. And so that gives us the grace space in which to do our best, with what we can.
Lincoln said, "You need to think like God thinks."
Yeah, and of course, Abe said that because he knew the Bible, and he knew that Jesus told him that that's what he was supposed to be trying to do, to see it from God's viewpoint, to love his fellow man as God loves them. Sometimes those Most High observers who are, acting as the direct agents of the Father, see to it that 11 armies are decimated by Abraham. Okay. Sometimes you have to, definitely.
Is it possible to do the wrong thing the right way? And obviously I would think not. But you know where I'm going. I'm glad you're laughing. Does that have any...
There's actually a whole section.
In a democracy, popular elections are the right way to do even a wrong thing.
Right. And that's the military way.
He's pointing out there's a whole bunch of discussion of those sorts of questions, back in the culture papers. One of the things that the Revelation is trying to help us with all these very difficult problems is try to give us a little bit bigger picture in which to view these things. You have little hope of doing the right thing if your initial assumption is there is no such thing as spirit or value. It's a purely material universe. The first thing you're doing is saying that there is no such thing as morality. The right and wrong don't exist. But even that aside, you're still going to be doing things. How likely are random acts going to do the right thing? In order to do the right thing, you have to have that subtleness of distinguishing in play, that the wisdom, insight, and foresight bring in. You have to be discriminating. It's not like, it's a 50-50 thing, and you got a 50% chance of plugging it into the right thing. Okay, most times what's right is a very small little spot in a big pegboard. Places you could plug this patch cord into. Most likely you're going to plug it in the wrong hole.
A random detractor, because you can just go where you want to go.
Right. You need to take delight in cultivating. That's right. I just remember there was another thing that came up. Who was it? I can't remember now who said that. That whole issue about morality. Well, it's like in the last section of the book. They're trying to get you to recognize we have an initial, very vague bottom-up viewpoint notion attached to the word morality. There's some validity to using the word morality. They did write the first line here. Just recognizing you can take it up and put an adjective in front of it. You want cosmic morality, not human, upwelling, exalted mores morality. Okay? Get yourself anchored in the cosmos and bring it down. And and there, and that that bit you brought up about morality and religious, you know, Jason, like they mentioned about moral and religious natures. I mean, see, obviously, if you're bringing things down, in order to get down to the fifth level, meaning you have to go through the sixth, there's going to be actual genuine religious nature involved in the consequent morality, as opposed to just something that's welling up and never really actually makes it up to the religious level. You know, it just becomes this exalted, emotionalized more system, you know, moralism, which passes for religion. You know, but it's really sub-religious, because you haven't actually gotten up. You know, you're guaranteed to have religion in play if you're bringing things from the top down. Okay, let's see. We were, I believe, here on man's choosing. Isn't that right where we were? Yeah, go ahead.
Man's choosing between good and evil is influenced not only by keenness of his moral nature, but also influences as ignorance, immaturity, and delusion. A sense of proportion is also concerned in the exercise of virtue, because evil may be perpetrated when the lesser chosen is in the place of the greatest as a result of distortion or deception. The art of relative estimation or comparative measurement enters into the practice of virtues of the moral realm.
Now, let's look at that last one first. The art of relative estimation or comparative measurement enters into the practice of the virtues of the moral realm. That sounds awfully scientific, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah, see, you're going to need this first cosmic intuition if you're really going to make this work. This has to be holistic. It can't be just the second cosmic intuition. It needs to be all three. But when you're directly engaging moral issues, okay, it's leading, but right there with it, to keep everything in proper cosmic harmony, are the first and third cosmic intuitions.
We have a term for that, right? And we call it add up. Is it going to add up?
And definitely do that. You know, it's one thing they want you to do. I gave you some suggestions as we're going along here. There's a lots of sort of adages that we have, you know, that you can bring out of the platitude domain, you know, and get them say, oh no, I know literally, in terms of the physics of the cosmos, what that's referring to. You want to get them to that point where you're directly, you know, you've taken them out of their blurry space, and you can get a hold of them firmly and use them, you know, from a position of recognition of what it's actually talking about. Okay, so man's choosing between good and evil is influenced not only by the keenness of his moral nature. Okay, so keenness. So you have this insight, and you can take a little space here, and you can very precisely focus in. And you know, you have a very keen, a very focused discernment. Okay. But you know, it may be pretty circumscribed, the space of your keenness. That's the ignorance part. Ignorance, you know, is a lack of breadth of perspective. You know, you may have great keenness in this little area, but you're just clueless about how to bring morality into all this other space. Okay, so that could be an issue. Immaturity, you know, may just be time. I mean, this stuff is all being realized in time. You can't just snap your fingers and be an adult of God. So, you know, it's always going to be time in play from here to eternity. That's going to be in play. And then the delusion thing. See, you know, you notice that this is kind of, you know, bringing up that what you brought up. You're not the poster child of delusion, but and obviously that's, you know, that like we were talking about can be a problem, because it's very easy even if you're not wanting to exalt the lesser into the greater, delusion can be in play. You can out of immaturity, stumble into delusion. Yeah, you know, and of course, yeah, then you start bringing in a little more active, you know, that self-righteousness thing is really fun because it's always right. You know, we start to actively delude things, you know, falsely exalt them. Now, this sense of proportion is also concerned in the exercise. What adjutant gives you the ability to bring in balance and proportion into your contemplation?
Seventh.
Yeah. The energy of symmetry, seventh adjutant. Okay, you know, before it's the spirit of wisdom, it's just that energy of symmetry, something that can consciousize the notion of balance and proportion. Yeah, see, so they're reminding you, don't forget, it's wisdom, insight, and force, all three of them. You definitely want to bring your wisdom into play when you're trying to use your insight. An example of how I tried to... you know, sort of specifically lead you through a thought process like this is in that little War and Peace paper I wrote years ago. You know, I specifically bring that up about bringing this seventh adjutant into your assessment. You know, you have to bring in this ability to assess the balance and proportion of things. So if you want to contemplate that further, you can go back and look at that old War and Peace single-page thing I wrote.
There's something running through my mind. It's probably very materialistic, but in this present-day conflict about fracking, and, you know, maybe on one hand there's a value of some increased oil, but on the other hand, water is essential to human life. And if you're going to take millions and millions of gallons and pollute it and pour it down in the ground where you can never get it back in pure form, it seems to me that's an issue of value.
Well, see, the tricky part there is how to assess it, how to evaluate it. See, how to bring value out of the unity domain and into this discussion. The first thing, of course, is you said right up front, you recognize that, well, we're talking about material issues here. You know, and even my mortal life is just that, my mortal life. You know, every mortal dies. Every mortal self dies. So you don't want to blow that out of proportion. So
I also don't
want to
have it happen prematurely.
Right. So you have to, you don't want to... You want to be careful to not take two different sort of sets of material facts, you know, sort of that are basically on the same level, and draw a line between them and say there's value on one side and not on the other. You know, that's the first mistake people usually make is creating a dichotomy of things and saying one is value and the other is just things. It's like, no, they're both just things. and it may very well be that value can be brought into both sides of things. The unity can be brought into relationship with the individuality on both sides. You know, remember, the Supreme Mind is really good at this. It can take any set of facts and lead them towards goodness. It has no limitations. Any set of facts, any possible finite set of facts can be taken to goodness by the Supreme Mind. So the more, advanced my mind is, the more I could take. You know. So this is a complicated thing. I mean, you got to really get into origin, history, and destiny a lot and try to think about the big picture. And again, the fact that they give us so much about our origin, history, and destiny is meant to help us with some of these questions. A quick little sort of subtext along that lines. When you're reading through the historical geology papers, if you had a historical geology course in college, in America, you would have learned that these the two geologic divisions, you know, in the time scale, were called the Mississippian and the Pennsylvanian. If you had taken this course in Europe, you probably would have lumped those two together and called them the Carboniferous. And as you're reading through the Rancho book, you notice that they lump them together and call them the Carboniferous. You go, well, I guess they like the European method. It's like, well, no, wait a minute. It can't be that. This book is the revealed truth, not facts. So why did they choose to use that designation Carboniferous, carbon-bearing layer? There's truth in that fact. The truth of the fact of that carbon-bearing layer is that it was put there on purpose. That carbon was stored to be used later by civilization. Now, if you don't believe in God, if you don't believe the universe has a purpose, you know, you'd roll your eyes at that statement. But everything has a purpose, okay? That was put there for us. There's a reason why before there are animals, there's nothing but plants, and they are going crazy because there's tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and they're loving it. And they're pulling that carbon dioxide out of the air and storing it, which coincidentally is going to make it so that, you know, animals that can't live if the carbon dioxide is too high, it's going to make the atmosphere good for them. And then eventually those animals are going to become humans and they're going to need to burn fossil fuels and ta-da! Yeah. See, I mean, it's all part of the evolutionary process. Someone had foresight to save that carbon for future use. I wonder who that was. This must have been a really big person. Yeah. See? God had that foresight. See, so it's that, you know, bringing in those sorts of thoughts can really transform the way you think about some of these human issues that we're wrestling with. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that somewhere in the book here is the answer to some specific, you know, question that we're ruminating on. But boy, if you come at it with the revelation as your foundation, you have a lot of more sophisticated thoughts in play when you go to make these decisions, which is hard. You know, that's one thing that a lot of humans love about the current philosophic chaos. It's easy. There aren't any difficult things to contemplate. You know, you can just have whatever you want. Self-righteousness is really cool. You know, if you want this to have value, you just declare it has value. You don't have to try to figure out if it actually does. So, but you know, that's what I encourage. You know, is bringing in those sorts of bigger picture senses.
And then you always perforce must serve two masters. So there, you really want a dilemma. You really want to be locked on the horns of a dilemma. Serve two masters, because as long as we're in a physical body, we are perforce must serve.
Right, and she kind of brought that up. I mean, it's not like you can ignore the fact that we need water to live. I mean, you know. Intense spiritual idealists, you know, have tried that. It's like, you know, I don't need water. I don't even need food. You know, I can just live on air, because that's how idealistic I am.
But
it's also important to not let the animal origin self totally rule. It's like, well, water. You can't let that desperate, parched-lipped self have the final word on everything. Okay. See, so it's a balance. Okay, let's get a little more in here.
Man's moral nature would be impotent without the art of measurement, the discrimination embodied in his ability to scrutinize meanings. Likewise, would moral choosing be futile without the cosmic insight which yields the consciousness of spiritual values? From the standpoint of intelligence, Man ascends to the level of a moral being because he is endowed with personality.
Okay, two little things to stress there. We kind of mentioned both of them. Just notice they're stressing them again. So you say, okay, you've got the moral intuition, your moral discrimination, your second cosmic intuition, and they're reminding you, but don't forget, you have to bring what's below into play and what's above into play. Man's moral nature would be impotent without the art of measurement, the discrimination embodied in the ability to scrutinize meanings. Remember how we were talking about that discrimination relative to meanings, that's the wisdom. Okay. So you have the fifth level of meaning, and you're going down through the fourth and the third. You're going to actually do something. If you couldn't bring it down, it would be impotent. Okay. So they're referring to bringing the bottom leg in, actually bringing it into play, purposing energy, power, potent. See? Okay, so bringing that down into the individuality. Likewise, would moral choosing be futile without the cosmic insight, which yields the consciousness of spiritual values? You gotta have the sixth level of meaning. You have to have the third cosmic intuition too. So again, they're just reminding you that to never lose sight that you want these to be a perfectly harmonized triunity, and you rotate one of the three facets forward depending upon what is immediately in play, but the other two are right there. Now, if I rotate the scientific facet forward because I'm going to try to think about some scientific things, trying to come up with some theories, my connection to God is right there with that. It has to be informing me that any scientific theory that demands there be no God is ridiculous. et cetera. Again, from the standpoint of intelligence. So if I'm standing on the third level of meaning, from the standpoint of intelligence, man ascends to the level of a moral being. Okay, so again, they're just putting in the levels of meaning, see, very literally. The only reason you have the upper domain of the hourglass is you're a person. The literal capacity, that upper domain of the hourglass, the fourth, fifth, and sixth levels of meaning, because of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit, giving you that initial thread of supremacy of nature, giving you a selfhood, not merely an animal origin self, the lower domain of the hourglass, but giving you a potentially ongoing self, potentially immortal self, a selfhood, and the personality identifies with that selfhood. So again, they're bringing in a little bit of the facts again, so that you're never losing sight of the details when you're starting to feel the spirit of it,
the bigness of
it. Feeling the spirit of the Holy Spirit. Don't get lost in the unity. it's a holy spirit. Don't forget about the whole part. Okay, it has to be a whole still. That's a triunity.
Keeps you grounded.
The personality that actually allows us to make a moral choice?
Well, I mean, of course, the choice part. The personality is what allows you to make a choice. The second cosmic intuition is what allows there to be a moral choice. Okay. Yeah. It's like faith. Faith requires personality and the third cosmic intuition. It's personal recognition. Personality does the personal part. The recognition is the spiritual insight. You're working them together. Again, the personality, isn't so much a thing like the three cosmic intuitions are. It's a purposing of it's a potential to purpose something. So faith is a purposing of the third cosmic intuition. A moral choice is a purposing of the second cosmic intuition. All right, a little bit more.
Okay, morality can never be advanced by law or force. It is a personal and free will matter and must be disseminated by the contagion of the contact of morally fragrant persons with those who are less morally responsive, but who are also in some measure desirous of doing the Father's will.
Okay. A couple of big things in there, the beginning and the end of that paragraph, basically. Okay, everyone knows about problems with that first part. Morality can never be advanced by law or by force. You know, the expression, legislate morality. Okay, but notice it's not just law there or by force. Doesn't matter if you say, well, okay, I won't use the legislative branch. I'll use the executive or the judicial branches. I'll use the force. No, none of the three branches of government can be used to advance morality. Okay, and we all know on both sides of our political dichotomy, there can be a tendency to think that you can use one of the branches or all three of the branches of government to advance morality. Okay? No. Can never. So just forget about it. Okay? They're trying to very definitively lay that down. Not one shred will you advance morality with government. Doesn't matter how big you make the government or how well-intentioned you are in your construction of the government, regardless of the size. Not going to happen. You need to have done that first step, like I was pointing out. Before you engage others, you need to make yourself part of the cosmos, which has a fragrance to it. Okay? If you are right with the cosmos, if you conform with the cosmos, you will be, as they're describing here, you will be a contagion. Okay? You will be noticed by the delightful odor, the fragrance of your personage. That's the way it must happen. We need God-conscious citizens, not cleverly crafted or forceful government. We need God-conscious citizens. We need adults of God. And then that last part. So this contagion thing, of course, it only works if there's some potential of receptivity. I mean, it doesn't matter how contagious you are, you're not going to make an animal moral. You know, and if you got a whole bunch of people around you that you're wonderfully fragrant in the presence of, and they're functioning wholly at an animal level, and nothing's going to happen. You're not going to advance their morality. They will think so, yes. They will consider you to have a stench, and they will, right, exactly. We talked about that. Yeah. You smell like holier than thou. But who are also in some measure desirous of doing the Father's will. It's a very precisely crafted statement. Some measure, we'll see that, pick that up in the next paragraph, but desirous of doing the Father's will. Okay? They can't be desirous of merely consecrating their will to the Father's will. It has to be desirous of doing the Father's will for this contagion to work. They have to have taken some measure of delight in cultivating, at least in engaging the initial amount that they were given by grace, okay, and doing something with it. Not just being what you are by grace, but you're trying to do something with it. You're not just trying to be loving, for instance. I'm going to be loving. No, you need to be in loving service. You need to be trying to do something with it. Okay? Then and only then is that individual receptive to your what you have as a some measure of an adult of God to offer them. Okay, see, so they're very precise about that. And then just here, they bring it into even more focus.
Moral acts are those human performances which are characterized by the highest intelligence, directed by selective discrimination in the choice of superior ends as well as in the selection of moral means to attain these ends. Such conduct is virtuous. Supreme virtue, then, is wholeheartedly to choose to do the will of the Father in heaven.
Okay. So now some of that is kind of like what you were bringing up, Terry, again. You notice that? How, again, they're reminding you of moral acts or those human performances which are characterized by the highest intelligence. You have full-blown wisdom, for instance, is in play. Directed by selective discrimination. You've got all the discriminators, your insights in play. In the choice of superior ends, as well as that you're really using your foresight in order to really get those superior ends in play. So wisdom, insight, and foresight, as in the selection of moral means to attain these ends, as well as in the selection of moral means to attain these ends. So you're going to use all of your adjutant mind, too, to figure out the, all of the how and, when and all that stuff as well. Okay, so the whole ball of wax, the whole, gifts that you've been given are going to be in play. And then, notice the last part. Such conduct is virtuous. Okay, so that, just that statement. Okay, so you've got everything in play. Such conduct is virtuous. It needs to be, have this cosmic character. It has to be whole, very holistic. You're trying to connect in, to have a relation to the whole through the individuality of the whole. You're trying to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony. Very fundamentally holistic. So, supreme virtue. Okay, so now that this is in contrast to that last part, where it said, who are in some measure desirous? Okay, now look what they contrasted here. So if you go from virtue to supreme virtue, supreme is the total finite, about the total finite. Okay, well, how can I have a relationship to the total finite? I must have been given a capacity. And if I'm using that capacity to its bounds, it will be supreme-like, wholehearted. Okay? There's some measure on the one hand, there is wholehearted on the other hand. Okay? That little measure of wholeheartedness that you were given by grace, that little thread of supreme selfhood, is what the personality is identified with, which is, this very holistic, engaging fact. Coming from the Father transcends the distinction between individuality and unity and associativity. It's very holistic. His other gift, that's what it's within. The adjuster is within whatever measure of wholeheartedness you have. Well, you're given some by grace, so it can come. Okay? That's another way of recognizing what I've been saying here, that initial thread of encirclement in the Holy Spirit is a thread of supremacy. Obviously, if the creative Mother Spirit, the individuality of the whole, did that, it's going to be wholehearted. It's going to be supreme-like. All right? So it's one thing to have some measure of desire to do the will, to do the Father's will. Then you can take it up a notch to wholeheartedly to choose to do the will of the Father in heaven. Again, not just wholeheartedly to choose the will of the Father. To choose to do. One must do something as well as be something to have a relationship to God the Supreme. Supreme virtue. It's not going to be supreme virtue if it isn't the doing part, also.
Can I just ask a quick question about the thread of supremacy? We were talking about this, and I argued that since we have the thread of the supremacy, then that has to be that we have
a tiny bit of divinity. And then I read in the book that not to aggrandize your life, but only just to have reactions of humility.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, is there a thread of divinity in us?
Well, I mean,
whose image are you making?
Right. I mean, yeah, it you're given that initial thread of divinity by grace.
I just wanted to clarify. You haven't said it all night. You've said supremacy,
yeah.
And I've been waiting to hear divinity, and I don't see it in the book either. It never says you have a thread of divinity.
You're given a thread of deity likeness.
Well, then that's different.
Divinity, see?
Oh.
The tricky part, of course, is, you know, that thread of supremacy, there's an asterisk there. Because, you know, it is fundamentally attached to or threaded through a mortal self.
Right.
Okay. Now, Jesus definitely helped. Michael definitely helped here in giving us all thought adjusters. That guarantees that initial thread of supremacy is made soul. That's the, you know, its size is the size of that embryonic soul. Okay, because there's just the embryonic soul is just a copy of that thread of supremacy. Okay. So there's a, you know, that he gave you an additional gift of grace that selfhood, unless you squish that soul, is going to go beyond this life. That bit measure of divinity is going to go on beyond this life. And so, otherwise, that divinity would have evaporated, you know, when this mortal life ended. But of course, you know, even then, there's still an asterisk. You know, because even if that thread of divinity gets to the next life, you can still squish it there. You can still take that one thread and pull it out of your garment, okay, if you choose. And that's the humility part, you know, it's a tenuous gift of divinity. And probably even more problematic is something that I was alluding to as we were going through this. I mean, because we have that initial encirclement by grace, we didn't have to choose it, so we aren't really aware of its existence as this very definitively high fact, a divine thread. All it ends up doing for a lot of humans is bleeding a little bit of the fact of his existence down into the adjutant mind, and fostering delusion.
Because it empowers their subjective mind.
I mean, you know, it a little, the word moral bleeds down into the adjutant mind because the second cosmic intuition is there, for instance. And what do immature humans immediately start doing? Falsely exalting every ridiculous little thing into some absolute moral fact, you know? What is logical? My thoughts are logical. Yours are not. Now, I couldn't have such a delusional thought if there wasn't the first cosmic intuition, so that the word logic could trickle down into my ignorant consciousness for me to falsely exalt it like this, put me at the center of the universe. See, all these things tend to have initial negative tendencies in the hands of immature individuals, okay?
So when we see that in people, we can practice a little more patience.
Yeah. Or, you know, another one, you know, the personality has an absolute dimension to it. So, of course, what do humans do with that? They take some ridiculous thing and absolutize it. Right. Yeah. So
cool how they put the maturity right next to the delusion, because if you're not spending your time converting to maturity, you're probably converting to delusion.
Yeah, that's kind of the point I'm going to make. I mean, the delusion thing is just going to happen automatically because of this gift of grace. Delusion is just going to be in play. Because your adjutant mind is an incessantly clamoring, right? Right. For recognition and honor. So you need to, as soon as you recognize that delusion is a given, you got to go, whoa, I got to take hold of the reins here. or I'm going to be nothing but a ball of delusion in short order. Okay. I need to get a hold of this. I need to work on some recognition of personal responsibility to the cosmos and the consequent self-control, self-mastery that needs to start coming in play as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to take these gifts and I'm going to, you know, make a mess out of them. All right. Oh, okay, let's take a little moment to reflect on things here.